Welcome, everyone. Real pleasure that you all are here, because today we have part two of the lecture by Lord Professor Robert Skidelsky. Robert, of course, was, by the way, as most of you know, so I won't give too much of an introduction to Robert himself. Robert was at Warwick for many years, and in particular in the economics department for a good 4 or 5 years as a regular faculty member. And there's therefore that strong connection with Warwick that Robert has, and which is fantastic to have someone of his caliber, his esteem, to be connected with Warwick. And I'm hoping that as we go forward, we will make a deeper connection with the economics department and Robert in inspiring our students and so on further. So without further ado, I want to pass it over to Robert. Thank you very much. Robert.
Thanks. Thank you very much for those words. These are lectures on economic policy, and particularly macroeconomic policy, so they're quite heavily policy-oriented, because I think at this moment in time, especially when so much policy is in flux, economic theory economists can make a major input. I don't think they're always willing to do so, but they can make a major input, and this is a challenging time to be studying economics beyond just the careers you might expect. Anyone who has any curiosity about the subject will realize it's a good time to be doing economics, because the subject itself is in flux, and many of the curricula perhaps are going to be modified and revised over the next few years in the light of the economic collapse. I suppose last time I talked about problems in fiscal policy. This time it'll be problems in monetary policy. I think for completeness, I perhaps should have done a lecture also about problems in international monetary policy, but maybe that for another time. We're still reeling from the impact of the banking collapse of 4 years ago. The much promised recovery has been elusive, to put it mildly. At first, the Chancellor placed his hopes on the confidence-boosting effects of fiscal consolidation, which is what I talked about last time. Now, we're told that recovery will come from ever more aggressive monetary policy, and that's what I want to talk about. But with the Bank of England rate of 0.5% and £325 billion having been injected into the economy over the last 3 years, 6.3 million people are still unemployed, underemployed, discouraged. This is the broadest count we have. And GDP growth is barely managing to stay positive. So it seems we have a problem. And is monetary policy the answer to the problem? Well, first I want to do a bit of historical background. Monetary policy in the three decades leading up to the financial crisis was supported by a set of ideas which were almost universally accepted. And the four most important ones were: there's no long-run trade-off between output and employment and inflation. Inflation has high costs and is to be avoided at all costs. Expectations are critical to monetary policy outcomes. And a strong nominal anchor is the key to producing good monetary policy outcomes. Now, by the mid-1970s, these ideas had convinced governments and monetary authorities in much of the OECD that central banks should be targeting monetary aggregates. In 1975, the Federal Reserve of America began to announce publicly its targets for money growth. In 1976, the UK began formal publication of its M3 targets, but quite quickly it became clear that large swings in the velocity of money undermined any presumed relationship between money target and the growth variables, inflation and national income. So at the same time, economists, in this new world, were drawing attention to the time inconsistency problem inherent in monetary policy. Kaedler and Prescott, Calvo, Barrow and Gordon, and others argued that optimal monetary policy on a day-to-day basis would not deliver the best long-term results. Governments will always be tempted to exploit the short-run trade-off between output and inflation in order to boost employment, and say the only result will be accelerating inflation. And this time inconsistency problem suggested the need to replace the money aggregate target by a stronger nominal anchor, and that became an inflation target. So what you had was a fundamental shift from the late 1970s, the adoption of an inflation target and the independence of the central bank so that it wouldn't be subject to these political temptations to monkey around with the money supply for political purposes. Inflation targeting builds on the most successful element of monetary targeting, the institutional commitment to price stability, but overcomes the key weakness of monetary targeting, the weak relationship between money and income. It does this by targeting the goal variable itself. This allows it to take all information into account that may affect the goal variable rather than limiting itself to an intermediary variable like money aggregates. And by linking policy with outcomes directly, it puts pressure on the monetary authority to explain outcomes when they differ from objectives. So this set the scene for the conduct of monetary policy from the mid-80s onwards. In 1989, the Bank of New Zealand became the first independent inflation-targeting central bank. In rapid succession, this was followed by Canada, Israel, the United Kingdom, where inflation targeting began from 1992, and independence came with the 1998 Bank of England Act. Sweden, Finland all followed. With the creation of the European Central Bank, the notion of independent inflation targeting central banks became inscribed in the DNA of any jurisdiction which had any claim to self-respect. And it seemed to work. In the 15 years following the adoption of inflation targeting, the average annual rate of inflation was 8.25. In the 15 years after, it was 2.69. And so it seemed that this regime was delivering the results it promised. That a correlation is not a cause escaped those who attributed low inflation to inflation targeting and claimed that inflation targeting had abolished boom and bust. In fact, such was the perceived success of monetary policy that it seemed to make fiscal policy unnecessary. Monetary policy would do all the stabilization necessary. And the consensus was that given the right monetary environment, the macro economy would be cyclically stable. Not only was there no need for more than marginal fiscal interventions by the government, but there was very little need for regulation of financial markets. According to the efficient market hypothesis, traders and businessmen endowed with perfect rationality as well as perfect foresight would take in all the information available and arrive at the correct prices. All that fiscal policy and regulation would do was to introduce All that fiscal policy and financial regulation could do, according to this view, was to introduce distortions and rack up debt. To the extent that any policy was needed, therefore, it should come from the central bank. By lowering interest rates, it could offset any downturn, and by increasing interest rates, it could prick any bubble. And then on the financial deregulation side, you had the elimination of all the financial controls that had been established following the Great Depression of 1930, most noticeably the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States in 1996, but we had equivalent deregulating measures in the United Kingdom from the 1980s onwards. In summary, if policy in the first post-war decade had been guided by John Maynard Keynes's motto, look after unemployment and the budget will look after itself, the decades preceding the financial crisis of 2008 lived by Milton Friedman's slogan instead, look after money and the economy will look after itself. But it didn't. The first 7 years of the 2000s saw a debt-fueled speculative spree of historic proportions, which in 2007-08 was followed by an equally spectacular collapse. Rather than abolishing boom and bust, Gordon Brown's government found itself in the midst of the greatest boom and bust in 80 years. And as I explained in my lecture in January, the Bank of England and government initially tackled the crisis together. In the November 2008 pre-budget report was an emergency budget. Among its key provisions, it brought forward capital spending and temporarily reduced the rate of income tax from 1715 to 15% in order to stimulate the economy. In fact, the fiscal stimulus was rather small, and most of the repairing job was done by monetary policy. Interest rates were slashed from 5% to 2%, then 0.5%. The Bank of England provided emergency liquidity to the banking system. There was some additional fiscal activity because £50 billion of taxpayers' money went to recapitalize Northern Rock and RBS and Lloyds. Even this small fiscal stimulus, though, became increasingly controversial as attention switched in the autumn of 2009 to fiscal consolidation. However, in the spring of 2009, the Bank of England started its program of quantitative easing, to which I now want to turn. Yes, so what it was doing, you know, in the year following February 2009 was buying government securities to the tune of £200 billion. And it has since bought another £125 billion, making £325 billion in all. When it started its second round, QE2, as it was known, last October, skeptics argued that it would have little effect because the borrowing rates on government debt were already at record lows. But David Miles of the MPC, who I think was here a short time ago, disagreed. And I quote what he said. I believe there are very good reasons for thinking that purchases of government bonds in exchange for money created by the central bank will have an impact on a range of asset prices and will influence the cost and availability of credit to the private sector. On the 8th of March this year, that is just about a week ago, the FT published a volley of criticism from pension funds. Criticism of the policy of quantitative easing. And what the pension funds claimed was that by keeping gilt yields so low, quantitative easing was hitting savers and pensioners. Bank of England officials replied that quantitative easing, QE, bolstered the prices of higher-yielding stocks and bonds that the pension funds carry. And Larry Elliott of The Guardian supplied his own list of winners and losers. Again, this was on the 8th of March. The lower interest rates and the higher asset prices have made mortgage and asset holders winners, together with exporters who benefit from the depreciation of the pound, and banks who have ended up with a lot more cash. These are all winners from quantitative easing. On the other hand, the lower interest rates have made savers, and particularly pensioners, worse off. They have also increased commodity prices, which have reduced the spending power of consumers. So, I mean, there's a mixed bag of reactions to this policy. And so how do you set about analyzing its impact? Let's start with some theory. In the Treatise on Money, which was a book Keynes wrote, was published in 1930, he recommended the method of open market operations be carried out à l'outrance, in other words, to the utmost extent, in face of a severe collapse in the economy. And what that meant was that the central bank buy longer dated treasury debt in sufficient quantities to get the long rates down. Both Ben Bernanke at the Fed and Mervyn King, who's governor of our central bank, bought the monetarist analysis of the Great Depression, which attributed the depression to the failure of the Fed to pump enough money into the banking system from 1930 onwards. And that is the monetarist explanation. It's now, I think, quite generally regarded as the main explanation of why the Great Depression was so deep and lasted such a long time. In this spirit, following the near collapse of the banking system in 2008, the Bank of England took the initiative of substantial asset purchases to ease the credit markets. And the key objective of the Bank of England was to provide liquidity to the non-bank financial sector, the other financial corporations, as they're called, by swapping their longer-dated assets for central bank money. These OFCs wanted liquidity so much, it was felt, that they would be willing to give up bonds paying 5% for cash, which pays 0.5%. And that, of course, was thought to produce a short-term profit, quite considerable profit for the central bank. But because these profits were short-term, assuming that the bonds would be sold, they would have to be sold later, purchases of outstanding debt running to several percent of GDP evidently called for treasury backing. So I think there was a quasi-fiscal element in this security purchasing program right from the beginning. And that is a point I want to emphasize, which is that fiscal policy and monetary policy have started to become less distinct as the financial crisis hit. One question I sort of asked myself was, and I've asked myself a number of times as this policy of quantitative easing developed, why didn't the central bank simply buy securities from the banks? Why did they have to buy them, or why did they buy most of them from the non-banks financial system? The answer is, I think, twofold. One is that the banks didn't hold enough securities for a quantitative easing program as big as the Bank of England wanted to apply. They didn't hold enough. And secondly, buying them from the non-bank financial sector created two channels of transmission instead of one. It enabled the OFCs to invest in riskier products, like corporate bonds and equities, and it increased bank reserves by the amount of the increased deposits from these OFCs. So you had these two channels, and that was said to be able to produce the maximum impact, the maximum multiplier effect from the program of QE. And behind the policy of QE lies the familiar quantity theory of money. It is a quantity theory of money. If you learn the quantitative theory of money, that's what you need to know to understand the rationale for this policy that was adopted from 2009 onwards. I mean, you know, you all know MV equals PY, and this is simply an identity. It doesn't mean anything other than the amount of money spent is equal to the amount of goods bought, and it doesn't require a genius to understand that identity. It becomes the quantity theory of money, it becomes a theory of the price level when three conditions apply. Constant velocity of circulation, constant output and an exogenous money supply. More precisely, the changes in V and Y are independent of changes in M. When we then have the quantity theory, a change in money produces a proportional change in prices, and this is the only effect. In other words, if you double the supply of money, you double price, the price level. That's the quantity theory of money. And that's equivalent to saying that money is neutral in its effect on real activity. So you start from there and you say, well, by what mechanisms are an increase in the money, by what mechanisms do they have their effect on prices? And that we can identify two mechanisms, direct and indirect. The first is helicopter money. The direct effect comes from the new money being directly spent or distributed by those who produce it. Helicopter money is the simplest form. You know, a helicopter just scatters a lot of notes, and everyone gets pocketfuls of them. And then, assuming that they go to people, with a very high propensity to spend, that you get a direct impact of an increase of the bank money on the spending of the population and on its incomes and therefore on its spending. But modern methods of QE, unfortunately, don't rely on this direct effect. I wish they did. We would all be out of the slump if that was the method adopted. In fact, one of the earliest quantitative easing people, though he didn't call it that, in the 19th century, called Silvio Gesell, actually advocated something like this when an economy collapsed. And he advocated stamped money. They were basically spending vouchers. Everyone got a time-limited spending voucher. It had to be spent within a certain period of time, or else the notes disintegrated. They were. They were no longer legal tender. So that was good. I mean, it ignored the propensity to import, which would have reduced the effect. But it was a good sound scheme, and versions of it were adopted actually, though they weren't recognized as such in the early days. The government did actually give money, direct money to people who, say, swapped their old cars for new cars. They gave them, I think, £2,500 for doing that. That's a form of helicopter money. But that was only on a very, very small scale. Modern methods, as I say, rely on indirect mechanisms. The most widely accepted account runs as follows. For convenience and precaution, people choose to hold a certain fraction of their income in cash, and this is a demand for real balances, command over a certain quantity of goods and services. When the central bank purchases existing securities from financial institutions, those institutions find themselves with too much cash in their portfolios relative to what they believe themselves to need to fund their expenditure. And they therefore go out and buy substitute assets. Is that me or someone else? Since whoever they buy these assets from find themselves in exactly the same situation, this process then repeats itself until the prices of all assets rise to bring the cash balances of all institutions in real terms back to where they were before. So that's how it's meant to work. And this, of course, theory holds just as true of individuals as of institutions. Now, if for that to work, though, notice that it's necessary for all the agents concerned to have correct anticipations. Anticipating, say, a 10% rise in prices, people spend the extra 10%, making the anticipation self-fulfilling and leaving their real balances unchanged. Formally, the price level is what equilibrates the supply of cash with the demand for cash, the demand to hold cash. So, this theory was subject to a famous refutation by Keynes, not in the general theory, but in the Tract for Monetary Reform, when he said, in the long run, the quantity theory of money, this in its cash balances version, is undoubtedly true. But in the long run, we're all dead. And economists set themselves too easy, too useless a task. If all they can tell us when the storm is long past, that the sea is flat again. And that, I think, basically Milton Friedman developed this insight, and he argued that the quantity theory of money was a long period theory, and in the short run, the postulated relationship between money and money income did not hold. You could have, because of uncertainty and people not knowing about the future, the money, the M also affected the V, and it also affected the Y. Consider first the effect of a change of M on velocity, assuming uncertainty about future prices. When when bank increases the money supply, people will speed up their purchases, expecting prices to go on rising. And the speed up in velocity will cause nominal income to increase more than proportionately to the increase in money. And in the reverse case, people will postpone their spending, expecting prices to go on falling. They'll expect prices to go on falling, but they won't know how much they will fall. In other words, there's not perfect foresight. They see the sign is negative, but they don't know how, and so they hold up. So you have effects of V on any change in M. And that means that the independence of V and M is not guaranteed. So basically, what you have is a change in money issued by the bank, will either bring about a proportional change in nominal income split between Y and P in the short run, and a proportionate change in the long run in the price level itself. But in the short run, as Keynes said, could encompass the rise and fall of empires, it's indeterminate. You don't know, actually, what the effect of quantitative easing is going to be. And from a monetarist point of view, then you have an explanation of both the collapse you have an explanation both of the boom that preceded the slump. Too much money was being created by the central bank, particularly the Fed in the United States. This was the theory of the money glut, too much money. And then when that collapsed, the money supply collapsed. And you had, you had a slump. In both cases, the central bank was not doing its job of maintaining a steady growth in the money supply. It was issuing too much money in the first case and too little in the second case. That's fine. I want to now introduce the first of my figures. I think the general explanation now we accept for the pre-recession record is that the central banks of the Western world, led by the Fed, made credit too cheap and plentiful in the years leading up to the crash of 2008. The injection of credit fueled an asset boom based on houses and commercial property, a debt-fueled consumption boom built on the back of these rising asset prices. But this didn't spill over into general inflation because the supply of cheap imported goods from East Asia more than kept pace with the increased demand. In other words,
the theory that all you needed to do was to target inflation left out the disturbing effect of an asset price bubble, which, when it collapsed, threatened the banking system with insolvency. And not only the American domestic banking system, but through securitization and credit default swaps and the global connection of the banks actually made a large part of the banking system of the world insolvent. It's extraordinary that a single price, the movement of a single price, which was the housing, the price of property in the United States, could produce a worldwide slump. But that is one of the things that globalization produces around. And when you have banks that are global banks, then you get the pain transmitted from one center to another, and it spreads like wildfire, as it did in the autumn of 2008. The collapse of the real estate boom in 2007-8 hit the banks which had overlent to this market, firms which had overinvested in commercial property, and the consumers who had borrowed for consumption on the back of rising house prices. So you had this movement down. Everyone found themselves with hugely impaired balance sheets. The pile-up of bank losses led to a credit freeze. Everyone started deleveraging, and this brought about a collapse in the money supply, which spread recession to the whole economy. You can see that collapse there, and then I've got similar English. There's the American figures. Notice the recovery of money growth, and notice the British experience. Now, both countries actually embarked on programs of quantitative easing. And the first obvious thing to notice is the similarity. I mean, the collapse is more or less of the same kind of dimension, but the growth, the recovery, is very, very different. So this then is the rationale behind monetary stimulus and the explanation of why fiscal policy has no place in dealing with the crisis. According to monetarists, the main reason behind the current slump is the collapse in the money supply. Consequently, for monetarists, the correct response to this is to print enough money to offset the buildup of cash reserves by both the banks and the non-bank sectors. Harking back to the idea of helicopter money, if people all of a sudden find they hold cash in excess of their demand for real balances, they'll start spending it. And in his paper, Monetary Policy at the Zero Bound, a leading British monetarist, Tim Congdon, he's on the extreme wing here, argues that, I quote, an increase of 10%, 20%, or 30% in M2, that's the US broad money, broad money indicator, would raise equilibrium national income, if not by exactly 10, 20, or 30%, at least by a number that would be within striking distance of 10, 20, or 30%. That is almost one for one. That is almost pure quantity theory of money reasoning. Well, what's actually happened? If that had happened, if in fact 325 billion, which has been injected into the economy, which is about 20% of GDP, had actually had a one-to-one effect on national income, we would be in the middle of an inflationary boom. But we're not. So what's wrong? What's wrong? What went wrong with that theory? Well, let's go back to what's supposed to happen when these agents, non-bank financial corporations and the banks themselves receive this extra cash. What's supposed to happen? There are thought to be two main effects, which are called the wealth effect and the portfolio balance effect. The first effect works by increasing the cash balances of the financial non-bank institutions, which according to the real cash balance hypothesis will prompt these institutions to go out and buy other assets. This drives up the price of these assets, which increases the wealth of the holders of the assets. In other words, they all feel richer, and because they all feel richer, they're going to spend more. So that's one way it's supposed to work. Then there's the portfolio balance effect, which works in a different way. And that works through lowering interest rates in the private credit markets. By increasing the cash balances of the financial non-bank institutions, the Bank of England simultaneously increases their deposits at their respective banks. So the non-banks get the money and their deposits with the banks grows by the same amount as the cash they receive, and on the basis of these augmented deposits, the banks can increase their lending and reduce their interest rates, which facilitates investment and which in turn leads to more output. The idea is that this additional relaxation of financial conditions for firms and households is simply the continuation of ordinary monetary policy, what monetary policy is expected to do when interest rates have hit their lower bound. So it's just what lowering interest rates is supposed to do. The Bank of England's quantitative ease QE was intended and expected to achieve its effect chiefly through this portfolio balance effect rather than the wealth effect. Whereas in fact, if it achieved any effect, it was probably through the wealth effect rather than the portfolio balance effect. The fact is, the Bank of England hadn't a clue what was going to happen. There's no accepted theory of how this extra money gets fed into the real economy. The only clue they would have had is if they'd actually given everyone a check, and then you could assume there would be, you know, some definite impact, depending on how much of that check people spent. According to the Congdon thesis, well, we ought to have been, as I said, in the middle of a huge boom, but we're not. And so I think you have to ask what went wrong, or just what happened. Financial assets have certainly recovered, and government bond yields have fallen. But banks have remained unwilling to lend and borrowers unwilling to borrow. The expansion in reserves has not translated into a proportional expansion in broad money and credit. In both the United States and the United Kingdom, bank lending to the business sector has in fact been contracting since late 2008. Over the past year, by 8.4% and 4.5% respectively. The growth in the money supply has been anemic. I'm talking about the UK here. In America, you have had better results. The wealth effect has proved elusive. Lower interest rates have not translated into an expansion of credit, and the American Fed strategy of targeting mortgage-backed securities has not brought about any substantial recovery in the housing market. It's too early to say what the eventual effect of all this will be. You know, I think it's certainly, I mean, my hunch would be that it prevented a slide all the way down to the depths of the Great Depression. Monetary policy was released earlier in this episode than was possible during the Great Depression, partly because monetary policy was constrained by the gold standard, and that kept interest rates high and prevented any policy of quantitative easing. It needn't have prevented it in the United States, but it certainly prevented it in the United Kingdom, in Britain. And so I think that's why the Great Depression was more severe than the recent slump has been. But nevertheless, we did have a substantial slump here. And the other point I'd make is that if you go back to this graph, you see that monetary policy was more successful in the United States in getting broad money supply growth. So the United States got a bigger bang for its buck. Now, I wonder if you can see all this. I get this table from a paper by Driffel and Miller, Marcus, which shows the differential impact of the two policies. And you can see there that the effects are greater. The impact on real output is bigger from the United States monetary QE than from the British. Notice it was 7% of GDP, whereas in Britain, the 200 billion had 14%. Now it's 325 billion, so you're up to 20% of GDP. But look at the positive effect on GDP. Perhaps 1.5% to 2% in the UK, 4% in the United States. I think we need to ask ourselves why the American results from QE seem to be much better than the British results. So if we take the counterfactual, what would the UK economy have looked like without the 200 billion and now the 325 billion policy of quantitative easing? Well, estimates suggest that you would have had no broad money growth at all. You didn't have very much. The velocity of broad money would have been 10% lower, and asset prices would not have improved, so you wouldn't have had the wealth effect. So what I'd say is and in addition, there might have been a prolonged collapse of investment as occurred during the Great Depression. And these figures strongly support the argument that there was some positive effect. The sign was in the right direction, but the effect was very, very weak. And of course, it was nowhere near what Tim Congdon claimed it would be. And the reason for this, I believe, and this is where I do go back to Keynes, the reason for this weak effect is that the quantity theory of money doesn't tell the whole story. This is because if what Keynes called liquidity preference, if the demand for money balances is increasing or has increased at the same time as the QE policy is being implemented, the injection of cash by the bank may not lower the rate of interest sufficiently to restore a full employment level of spending. As Keynes put it, and I quote, "If money is the drink which stimulates the system to activity, there may be many a slip twixt cup and lip." And the last 3 years has experienced not just one slip, but two slips. Despite the injection of all this high-powered money into the system over the last 3 years, annual broad money growth has not picked up. We've seen that from the original British figures. The new high-powered money has remained stuck in the banking system. The commercial banks hold on to their cash, either in the form of reserves at the central bank, or they buy other liquid assets. Commercial bank reserves at the Bank of England rose from 45 billion on March the 4th, 2009, the day before the launch of QE, to 165 billion 5 months later. In July 2009, balances available for lending to financial companies fell at its fastest rate since records started. And the total amount of loans taken out by households and non-financial companies remained anemic. The corporate sector from whom the bank bought the gilts did not use its helicopter money to spend in investments. It used it for deleveraging or for buying liquid securities. And the banks holding the augmented deposits of the corporate sector did not originate more loans. In short, the injection of money caused a stock market boom, but failed to make any big inroads into the real economy. On the 13th of February of this year, the BBC reported that a survey by the Federation of Small Businesses had found that 30% of the Federation's members said they had missed a growth opportunity because they weren't able to access finance at the right time. So cash hoarding creates a credit supply problem. So that's the first slip. The credit, the supply of credit for risk, more risky loans, as opposed to gilts, was not increased by very much. But that's the slip on the supply of credit. But there's also the question of the demand for credit. And this is the crucial distinction, again, Keynes made, between the cost of finance and the marginal efficiency of capital. That depends on expectations for profits. And when you have a policy that is actually a fiscal policy that is contracting demand, then profit expectations are also going to be depressed. And confidence is too low in the economy to enable private investment to pick up. So there's a supply of credit problem, which comes out of the impaired balances of the banks and their risk aversion, and there's a demand for credit problem. On the other side, it's not just that banks can't obtain the finance they need for projects they want to do, it's that they don't want to do the projects. They're holding back. They don't know what the future's going to give them. And so, under those circumstances, you have this block here, and that's why it's through ignoring the issue of demand, the question of demand, that the quantity theory of money actually falls down. It's entirely a supply of credit theory. It has nothing to tell you about the demand for credit, which of course is what causes the velocity of money to move around like anything. And so when I've been trying to inject some ideas into the policy debate, I argue that what you need to do under those circumstances is not leave it to the banks. Not tell the banks they've got to lend more, which is what Cameron and Osborne have been doing. Lend more, lend more, lend more. The banks simply say, well, no. We can't lend more. You're putting all these regulations on us. And we can't lend more. They may be playing a strategic game of some kind and using their refusal to lend as a way of aborting the extra financial regulations that the government are thinking of imposing on them. So how do you get a break out of that game? You bypass the banking system. And that's why I've suggested setting up a national investment bank, which would be able to mobilize through on better terms, mobilize private savings, particularly from pension funds, which are frozen, and they're getting a very, very low rate of return. They would be willing to invest in a bank that was offering a higher rate of return. And then if the bank was properly organized, you would be able to get an investment. On the basis of that, you'd be able to get investments in infrastructure, housing, transport, particularly green technology, all of those things that aren't being done at the moment, just because the supply of credit and the demand for credit are not there in the private sector. So that would be my way of breaking the logjam. But I just conclude with this observation. The last few years seem to have forged some new consensus centered on the monetary authority. In other words, we still believe that the monetary authority is the instrument for lifting a depressed or enfeebled economy out of a slump. However, although the Bank of England has played a crucial role in avoiding another Great Depression. It is not actually the great instrument for recovery that people have thought it would be. It can never hope to create a great recovery on its own. Monetary expansion is a necessary but not a sufficient condition. We need to pair the new innovations in monetary theory, such as macroprudential regulation and quantitative easing, with new innovations in fiscal policy, such as a new investment institution, and generally a steady stream of investment from that institution to offset the fluctuations in the marginal efficiency of capital. And that's how I think the two things have to come together in a new theory of macroeconomic policy, which is what we need. But we're not there yet, I think it's something that people will be thinking about in the next few years. I think we're going to move to a new theory. There's been going to be a revival of macroeconomic policy. We're going to have new principles of macroeconomic policy, new principles of public finance, new principles of financial regulation, and they're all being worked out. They haven't solidified yet, which is why it's a challenging time to be doing macroeconomics. Thank you very much.